Thank you. Thank you very much, David, for that kind introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, dear brothers and sisters. I normally don't start my speeches like this, but I was moved by seeing Nelson Mandela's release from prison. And as many of you know, on the 18th of July, he just had his birthday. In Africa, most of our politicians, when they are invited to speak at meetings, they usually come late. And somebody once said, you know, in Europe, people start speaking by telling a joke. In Africa, people start speaking by apologizing for being late. But let me start with a slight, sort of, not quite a joke, but it's a story doing its rounds in South Africa at the moment on email, which talks about Nelson Mandela passing away and going to heaven and St. Peter meeting him at the pearly gates. For those of you who don't know, Nelson Mandela is a Methodist by background, but has embraced a range of faiths in his life. And St. Peter says to him, "Oh, well, great to have you, President Mandela. Welcome. Let me give you a personalized tour of heaven." And after a few minutes, Mandela asks St. Peter, "St. Peter, why are there so many clocks all over the place?" And St. Peter says, "Well, you see, for every human being on earth, we have one clock. And every time they tell a lie, the big and, you know, moves once." So Mandela was quite intrigued by this. And St. Peter said, "Oh, come, let me show you a special room." So Mandela goes off and he says, "Well, this is the high-profile room. And these are the really high-profile people, you know, on the planet." And he says, "There's Mother Teresa's clock. As far as we know, it hasn't moved. There's Madonna's clock. It used to move every 5 minutes. It slowed down recently," and so on and so forth. And after a few minutes, President Mandela says, "But, you know, why isn't George W. Bush's clock here? He's one of the most high-profile people in the world." And St. Peter says, "Well, we used to have it here, but right now, Jesus has it in his office, and he's using it as a ceiling fan." So David was right when he said that I wanted to change the title slightly. In fact, it's just changing the words. Instead of wisdom, witness, and justice, I'm going to speak to witness, wisdom, and justice. And you'll see, hopefully, why that distinction is important. My dear brothers and sisters, the moment of world history that we are living in can be described as a perfect storm. What we have seen over the last 3 years has been a convergence of a range of crises that have hit humanity repeatedly in the solar plexus, one after the other. First, 3 years ago, we had the fuel price crisis. And as you all know, when we have a fuel price crisis, we then have, immediately following, a food price crisis. And it was just 2 years ago that 60 countries had food riots as a result of the food price hikes. Even though, by the way, fuel prices came down, food prices didn't proportionately come down after the fuel prices dropped. Then we have an ongoing poverty crisis, which takes the lives of 50,000 men, women, and children every single day from preventable causes. It is important that we understand that the poverty crisis that we face, which in my continent, for example, every single day takes the lives of 7,000 people, is taken by malaria, 6,000 by HIV/AIDS, and 1,500 or so by tuberculosis. If you want to put it in a common global narrative of the time that we live in, you could say that in terms of loss of human life, it's the equivalent of 5 September 11th every single day, in terms of the quantity of the loss of human life. So I want to put it to you that the poverty crisis is not simply a sad situation, a tragic situation, an unfortunate situation. The poverty crisis is a daily silent tsunami or a passive genocide that has been underway for such a long time. And those with power who can make the difference, both in developing and developed countries, have not exercised the leadership, courage, wisdom, and morality that this calls for. We have now the climate crisis. And according to Kofi Annan's Global Humanitarian Forum, in 2008 alone, we can now document 300,000 people dying directly from climate impacts. It is important, therefore, that we understand that it was only when the financial crisis hit that the most powerful of our political leaders, both in government and in business, really, really stood up and said, we are in a crisis and we need to do something different. But let's look in a moment as to how they have responded to the crisis. But let's just think about the world we live in for a few minutes more. According to the United Nations Development Program, what Western Europe and North America spends on pet food annually could provide the entire African continent with 3 nutritional meals per day. What the European Union spends daily on subsidizing every European cow to the tune of €2 a day is more than most people on this planet have to survive on a daily basis. By the way, they obviously not subsidizing the cows, they're subsidizing the farmers that own the cows, and shame, those poor cows do get killed at the end. But when you think about the level, I should just say, if any of you are from the Society for the Prevention for Cruelty to Animals, I've got nothing against cows or pets, but the issue is this deep structural inequality that manifests itself time and time over again when we look at how out of balance our world is between those richer parts of the world and the poorer parts of the world has to actually be addressed with a level of moral courage that we have not seen. According to the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, they point out that if we were to deliver the quality of lifestyle that everybody, say, in the United Kingdom and other developed countries enjoy, we would need to have the equivalent of 6 to 8 planets. Just think about that for a second. The problem is, we don't have a plan B in terms of addressing this accumulation of crises with the climate crisis driving things rapidly forward. We don't have a plan B because, quite frankly, we don't have a planet B. So this is one planet that we have, a finite reality, which must now challenge us in thinking about how we actually deliver to our children and grandchildren a more sustainable, a more peaceful, and a more just way of living for the future. When we think about poverty, it's very important that we actually understand the contradictions in terms of how poverty manifests itself. As an African, I can tell you that it pains me when people talk about Africa as a basket case. When Tony Blair said Africa is the conscience and the scar of humanity, people judge him differently, that he was serious about making a difference. Others say that he was trying to actually rehabilitate his Iraq war image. But irrespective of what his intention was, the reality of even those that sought and seek to support Africa and other parts of the developing world has often been done in a paternalistic way that does not exude solidarity and common and a sense of common humanity. So when we think about Africa, I say Africa is one of the richest continents underneath the ground. And precisely because we are one of the richest continents underneath the ground is why we are one of the poorest continents above the ground. It is great to see the focus now on the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, the tragedy that it is. But ask yourself, why have we not heard equal amount about the Delta Niger, Niger Delta oil spill, which has been going on for years and years and years, with the actual quantity of spillage and the impact of that spillage significantly more in terms of what we have seen? Shell has not paid compensation anywhere in the tune that BP will pay to the residents of Louisiana and so on, as BP should. But is the value of the human beings living on the Gulf of Mexico coastline any more valuable than those that live on the Niger Delta environments? Those are the difficult questions that we have to begin to now ask in the context of actually bearing witness. Can I just ask, how many of you have had association with Quakerism at any point in your life? I'm not sure, thank you. I'm not sure whether you know this, but the formation of Greenpeace just under 40 years ago was driven by the idea of bearing witness, which is a key component of Quakerism. It was when the US government was trying to set up and succeeded to do a nuclear test in Anchica Island near Alaska. That was the driving force of how Greenpeace was set up, and the first action they did was actually sailing to the test site to try to see what was happening and to tell the world and to bear witness. And it is important that right now we continue, as people who are concerned about justice and social justice, to tell the story of where injustice is happening and to tell it in honest ways, even if telling those stories actually put our lives in danger and actually call upon us to make sacrifices. So when we think about specifically the climate crisis that we face, you might have heard last year in the run-up to the Copenhagen summit where religious groups, trade unions, NGOs and so on all worked together in the run-up to Copenhagen to deliver what we called a fair, ambitious and binding treaty. In short, we called it a FAB treaty. Not a fabulous treaty, but a fair, ambitious and binding treaty. Sadly, what we got was a FLAB treaty. Pardon my French, but full of loopholes and BS. But the important thing about last year was there were a set of words that actually emerged that actually are quite revealing, and those that seek social justice anywhere in the world need to think about how to embrace. People started talking about climate injustice or climate justice as the demand. And what was behind that was that people in poor countries have been the least responsible for the climate catastrophe that we find ourselves in, but are the ones that are paying the first and most brutal price for it. I'm sure most of you know about the genocide in Darfur. When the genocide in Darfur is projected in the global media, it's solely seen as an ethnic conflict. But actually, the biggest driver of the Darfurian conflict is water scarcity and land scarcity, with actually ethnicity being manipulated in that context, as we have seen in so many different conflicts around the world. I never thought I would start a sentence like the way I'm going to start my next one. I strongly support the CIA and the Pentagon when they say that climate change is probably the biggest threat to safety, security in the future. And if we think today's wars are being fought about oil, sadly, if we do not get it right, and if we do not get a way where we can share this planet in a more equitable way, then sadly, I must say that what we will end up in is a catastrophe that will actually mean that many of the values that we hold will all be violated. So when we witness the world in that way, what wisdom then should we bring to it? And yeah, I want to just quote Albert Einstein when he once said, when you're addressing a big problem, don't use the same thinking, logics, and framework that got you in the problem in the first place. And sadly, our political leaders, in their response to the financial crisis, by the way, it was not a response to the convergence of all these crises coming together. And one of the things that we have to actually push back against is treating each of these crises as crises that are standalone, uninterconnected crises. Because if we do not see the interconnections between poverty and the environment, which are obvious, for example, if we do not see the connection between gender equality and climate change, because if climate change is going to be a driver of war and conflict, we know that in war and conflict, it is women and children that pay the biggest price. So there is a connection when we think about gender equity and women's rights, and you can make any number of connections. But our political leaders, sadly, decided that they could say to the world, we will find not millions, not billions, but trillions of dollars to bail out the banks, the bankers, and the bonuses, the very folks that actually contributed in getting us in the mess in the first place. But we will not find a fraction of that money to help poor countries who already, in the Pacific Island states, in parts of Africa and so on, are having to think about moving people who have now are in the process of becoming climate refugees. So what wisdoms do we take from the world we witness right now? And a key question that we have to ask ourselves is, how do we make change happen in a way that we secure this planet for our children and for the future? So what does history teach us? If we look at all the major, major injustices that humanity has faced over time, whether it was slavery, whether it was apartheid, whether it was a woman's right to choose, whether it was a civil rights movement in the United States, it was only when decent men and women said, enough is enough and no more, and they were willing to step up to the plate and say, as Nelson Mandela said as he went to court, he said, the struggle to end racial discrimination is a cause I am prepared to live for, and if needs be, it's a cause I'm prepared to die for. And if you think about all the struggles, colonialism included, it was when Rosa Parks, the African-American woman who helped liberate those that lived in slavery in the United States, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and a range of other people who were willing to put their lives on the line. And importantly, at the time that they were willing to put their lives on the line, they were called terrorists, communists, and a whole range of other derogatory words. And now, it's very interesting in South Africa, for example, you cannot find one, you will struggle to find a single white South African in South Africa that actually supported apartheid. I mean, you just can't find anybody, you don't know how that system survived. But, importantly, there are too many people who are willing. And yeah, I'm saying this in a self-critical way, that we have to ask ourselves, how does change happen? And if I look at the struggle against apartheid, I can say that one of the critical success factors of that struggle was that people of faith and people who were secular were able to come together and find common ground. I would say that as a 15-year-old high school student, I was expelled from school for engaging in a protest against apartheid education. I should confess, you know, we didn't really understand much as 15-year-olds, but, you know, we knew enough that, you know, like when we drove in a bus to school from our township to the center of town, you pass white neighborhoods and so on where you'd see really nice schools with actually grass on grounds and that kind of stuff, things that you never had in the townships. And so we had enough, but on a lighter note, the slogan at the front of the march was, in 1980, this first protest I participated in was called, "We Want Equality." By the time the slogan got to the back of the march, the young folks at the back of the march were shouting, "We want a color TV." But be that as it may, with the limited knowledge that we had, we got involved. And I remember at that stage, you know, young, 15 years old, angry, somewhat militant and so on. Then we were expelled from school for engaging in that protest, and there was a public meeting that was called by some of our leaders to try to, you know, launch a campaign to get us reinstated in school. And there was a priest called Reverend Paddy Carney. And the law that the government had just passed was a law saying that if you burnt the South African flag, you would get 5 to 15 years in prison. And Paddy Carney gave the speech, which is one that I hold dear in my heart, because it was the speech that shifted me from thinking that the struggle was between white and black, rather than from thinking the struggle was between injustice and justice. Because he said very eloquently, he said, "What is a flag? A flag is nothing more than a representation of the government." And then he said, "What is a human being?" And he said, "A human being is nothing more than a representation of God on earth." And then he said, "If this government violates the representations of God on earth every single day in 1,000 different ways, what right does it have to expect anybody to honor the apartheid regime's flag?" But what I saw in my activism days in South Africa is that the faith community provided us with courage, with moral leadership, with confidence to actually stand up against one of the most brutal regimes. I want to suggest to you right now that we have the opportunity and the challenge for us to actually stand up and be counted. And I think that the faith community is already engaging in the struggles of poverty as they've been doing for a long time. But they've embraced the issue of climate change quite intensively over the last decade. I have in my prepared notes, I can take you religion by religion by religion, but in the interest of time and for conversation, all I would say is, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Islam, whether it's different parts of Christianity, you know, the Pat Robertson, the evangelical church leader in the United States, claimed that he had an epiphany 2 years ago and is now a climate change advocate and so on. So basically things are happening in the faith community, and there's a simple reason for that. And that is, all our scriptures, if you look at it, which was what I was doing in preparation for coming to this talk, whether it's our holy books from Islam, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Hinduism, you can find very clear guidance in religious teachings that actually, in the context of creation care and taking care of what God has created, there is clear guidance that we should be treating all forms of human life, all forms of life, not only us as humans, with much more dignity and respect. So it is in that context that I think the time has come, and the reason I was so keen to come to this meeting was to say, to sharpen my own thinking, but also to say that I do not believe Greenpeace, WWF, Friends of the Earth, and all the more secular-oriented environmental organizations, which have been 20 years ahead in terms of warning us, but politicians have not heeded those warnings, neither have the corporate sector. And one of the reasons they've not felt the need to heed is because, I think, the voices of the faith community were not strongly heard in those debates. And even though it has started happening, I think that we have to ensure that people like myself, who are in the secular part of social justice movements, have to open up more space for our brothers and sisters in the faith communities, not only to participate, but to actually be part of the leadership moving forward. Because I have no doubt in my mind, and this brings me to my third wisdom, when what history teaches us. How do we get our politicians to listen to us? We write to them. When there's elections, we vote. But sadly, in many countries around the world, when people go to vote in elections today, they're not going to vote for the best candidate. They're going to vote for the least worst candidate. You know, people are not enthused about formal electoral democracy today, right? And so we march peacefully, if we get permission to march in certain societies. We hold rock concerts, we hold prayer meetings, we hold bake sales, we do house-to-house lobbying to educate people and so on. But here's the reality. Those with power, every moment of world history, there are very, very few instances where those that hold power give it away voluntarily, sadly. There are examples, more at the personal domain rather than the public domain. But it is only, history teaches us, when people are willing to engage in civil disobedience, are willing to break the law peacefully if necessary, that actually change happens. If Mahatma Gandhi didn't lead the salt march, and waves after waves of people went peacefully and got beaten by the British authorities on the ground in India, and that image that sent to the world, which outraged global public opinion, even at that time, minus email, Twitter, Facebook, and all the other new gadgetries we have to deal with these days. So I think that what I would, if I can be bold enough to say, and I'll tell you, a CEO of one of the biggest companies in the world just said to me 2 months ago, because he's somebody who gets it, I shouldn't embarrass him, and also I shouldn't alert the security police services in different parts of the world by telling who he is, but he has agreed to get arrested with me in an act of civil disobedience to actually get the message across. Now, the significance of that is the fact that we have to now, in terms of the wisdom to know what we have to do, we have to think out of the box, we have to think about new allies. I am very serious when I say that the Pentagon and the CIA or elements therein actually get climate change much better than the Congress of the United States does. And even though I know I will take criticism, and I am taking criticism in the 8 months that I've been at Greenpeace, I am committed to dialogue with those that we have not dialogued with before. Because the scale of the problems we face are much, much too large for any one of us to actually kid ourselves that government is going to do it alone, business is going to do it alone, or private sector or civil society is going to do it on its own. So I have this vision that we have to get organized, and we have to be able to put pressure on those most powerful governments that are holding back progress. And I'll just show you a quick conversation I had with Al Gore 2 months ago. It's trying to figure out how do we actually shift the agenda in the United States. And how because the United States is 4% of the world's population. They put about 25% of the harmful global greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. And they are the ones actually that are dragging the feet the most in terms of committing to ambitious targets and so on. There are a whole range of other countries that are not being great either. But when we think... So I was asking Al Gore, what can we do from the outside to support you know, the dynamic to get good legislation in the United States. And he said, you know, Kumi, I know you're at Greenpeace now, so I'm not saying Greenpeace should do it, but one of the things that could work, he said, could have value, is if we could have religious communities going to U.S. embassies and holding candlelight vigils overnight, appealing to our brothers and sisters in the United States to actually wake up and smell the coffee and get with the program, that would be helpful right now. And important, Greenpeace can organize it and have, you know, 1,000 people around embassies and so on. But why would the people of the United States feel moved just by Greenpeace doing it? It's very different when religious leadership steps forward and make that appeal. It has a much, much more different take. So to conclude, when we think, and to leave enough time for question and answer, I thought I should just, because David said something about, I was going to talk a little bit personally, I just wanted to share one personal thing with you about my own relationship with religion and spirituality. I was very privileged to grow up in a poor working class township, but which had a multi-religious culture. We had people of Christian, Muslim, and Hindu faith. And of course, when you have that kind of combination in apartheid South Africa at that time, you always had quite aggressive attempts at converting folks, particularly from Hinduism and Islam, into different parts of Christianity. And I remember a teacher was rather enthusiastic of this kind of more evangelical type of proselytizing, was saying in class, I was like about 11 years old, and he was saying, you know, my God doesn't ask for chickens, because you know how in Hinduism you slaughter chickens at certain rituals. He said, my God doesn't ask for chickens, my God doesn't ask for sheep, my God doesn't ask for cows. You know, you should all convert to Christianity. And I went home and I said, because I love this teacher, this is one of my favorite teachers, so I went home, and I was being brought up as a Hindu. So I went home and I said to my mom, quite traumatized, I said, Ma, you know, my favorite teacher says Christianity is the best religion, and we being brought up as Hindus and so on. And my mom said to me, all religions are the same. They just are rationalized and presented and so on in slightly different emphasis. And she said, the only thing you need to know about religion if you want advice from me is just think about these two things. See God in the eyes of every human being that you meet. If you can see God in the eyes of every human being that you meet, you don't need to bother whether you are a Christian or a Hindu or a Muslim or whatever. And always look at the weaknesses in yourself and look at the strengths in others. Sadly, my mom would commit suicide 4 years after that, when I was 15 years old. But that wisdom that she shared with me is something that has made me a bit of a unique and odd person within secular movements. I've only joined Greenpeace recently, but in all the movements that I've been involved in, I've always been a voice. We must work with our brothers and sisters in the religious community. And it doesn't matter, we don't agree on everything. And I'll give you a quick anecdote. You might remember the Make Poverty History campaign from 2005, right? The global part of that is the Global Call to Action Against Poverty, and I was the founding chair of that, the global part of the campaign. And we were having a meeting a year after the Make Poverty History campaign in 2006 in a meeting in Beirut, Lebanon, where suddenly there was a huge conflict between the religious folks and the women's movement. Because the women's movement in 2005 were okay to be silent on a woman's right to choose in terms of reproductive rights, in terms of abortion. But 2006, the dynamic changed, and they wanted language in the Global Manifesto, which was more explicit and articulated reproductive rights. Now, most of the folks from the faith groups that were there at this meeting, they themselves personally, in terms of their own personal values, you know, supported a woman's right to choose. But if they stayed in that meeting and agreed a clear language that supported reproductive rights, when they got back to their respective religious organizations, and sadly, whether we like it or not, interestingly, most of the representatives of that meeting were women from the faith groups, but usually they were going to be going back to report to some male leadership, and they would have taken some, you know, in fact, basically they said, we would have to withdraw if you have explicit language. So the whole conference, imagine there's like 400 people, all from different parts of the world, all continents. So we had to decide, how do we keep folks together? And I came up with this idea with a few others. I said, 5 people from the women's groups, 5 people from the religious groups, go into that room and don't come out until you'll have worked out a way on how y'all can stay together and keep all of us together. So the women's movement wanted reproductive rights. The global call to action supports reproductive rights. The faith groups wanted no reference to reproductive rights. And then they emerged 1 hour later saying, yeah, we've agreed and we found a way forward. And they came up with the language that said the global call to action against poverty supports reproductive health. It was less than what the feminists wanted, more than what the faith groups wanted, but they could live with it. And the bottom line is, if we are going to make success to advance social justice, we have to focus more and more on the much larger number of things that unite us, and to learn to respectfully disagree on the smaller number of things that disunite us. Because let's be clear, even in terms of very firm articles of faith and behavior that we interpret is suggested by those articles of faith, these things are not set in stone. They are actually changing over time. When Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who I must say, I don't know whether you heard the news, but just last week, he announced his retirement from public life. And I'll bet anybody in this audience that don't take that seriously. Adam and Eva is somebody I love and respect, and I've been privileged to work with him. And it was very moving for me just before I started at Greenpeace. I sadly had to lead a campaign and go on a hunger strike to put pressure on my government in South Africa to change its policy with regard to Zimbabwe, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu stood with me throughout that hunger strike. He fasted once a week with us and so on. But, you know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu went on public television in South Africa finally and said, I would prefer young people and older people did not have sex out of a firm committed relationship, but should you choose to, please wear a condom, right? Now, that's not something you would have thought the Archbishop of Cape Town, the leader of the Anglican Church in South Africa and so on, would actually go on television and do. You know, you wouldn't have thought about that 20 years ago, for example. But circumstances does sometimes call for realism, and where, in fact, you have to work out some compromises about how we think about the afterlife and how we think about life here on Earth. And the last thing I would say in conclusion is that my experience of at Greenpeace, I sort of was discussing, you know, when I started, they asked me, what's your vision and what you're going to change? So one of the things that we're going to do is work closer with religious folks. And people in some parts were like, wow. And then people said, why? I said, well, actually, you know, they got the best sense of humor of any groups that I've actually worked with. And I say this jokingly, but actually, you would be surprised at how earnest folks in secular civil society are about what we do. Extreme levels of earnestness. Whereas if you take a guy like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, if I can give you one anecdote, there was once a march to prison, to when Nelson Mandela was still in prison, to call for Nelson Mandela's release. In fact, that was one of the marches. It was a very famous march led by our religious leadership and some academics. And Archbishop Tutu was in the front of the march, and then he, you know, all of them were wearing their, you know, their religious garb and so on. And he linked hands, and then he decided, and he discovered he had linked hands with a white South African English professor, a guy taught English literature called Michael Savage. So you know, televisions and all are on this march, and Tutu realizes that he's got arms around Mike Savage, and he says, "Hey, Mike, good to see you. I'm glad you're in this march." He's marching with his academic gown, right? And then Bishop Tutu says on television, radio, and so on, "Yeah, Mike, we savages, we must stick together." and you know, I say that, I think, when I speak to young people, I always say that activism for justice is not a chore. It is a calling, it is an opportunity to build friendships, to give meaning to your life, and to know that one day when you die, when somebody asks you just before you die, have you tried to make a difference, you should be able to say, yes, I did. So in conclusion, I want to end with the anecdote, which is a little bit sad, but is intended to be motivational. When I was 22 years old, I was fleeing South Africa into exile. And my best friend at that time, a guy called Lenny Naidu, asked me a question. He said, "Kumi, what is the biggest contribution we can make to the cause of justice?" And I said, "That's a very easy question, giving your life." He said, "You mean going, participating in a demonstration, getting shot and killed and becoming a martyr?" I said, "I guess so, something like that." And he said, "That's a wrong answer." He said, "It's not giving your life, but giving the rest of your life." I was 22 years old that time. My friend Lenny was way ahead of his time. I think at that time, this is like in 1987, I think at that time he was probably one of 10 vegetarians in the entire African continent. I mean, he got climate change, he got environmentalism, he was quite special. So we flee into exile in different directions, and less than 2 years later, I get a call from home telling me that my friend Lenny and three young women from my home city was brutally murdered by the apartheid regime. There were so many bullets in their bodies, the parents couldn't recognize them at the mortuary. I had to think deep and hard about what he was trying to say in that message, in that distinction between giving your life and giving the rest of your life. What he was saying is that the struggle for justice, the struggle for gender equality, for sustainability, to eradicate poverty and so on, these struggles are marathons and they're not sprints. And those of us that have the luxury to be able to participate and contribute to actually waging these struggles for a more fairer and just world, the biggest contribution we can make is maintaining a lifetime of commitment, engagement, and perseverance until these struggles have been won and until these injustices have been eradicated from the face of the earth. But here's the problem. In essence, what he was saying, the struggle is a marathon, not a sprint. But the problem is, we don't have time anymore for a marathon. The science is telling us that if we do not get emissions to peak by 2015, latest 2020, we have catastrophic runaway climate change that threatens the future of human life, not just plant and animal life that we as a species have threatened. Al Gore, when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, evoked an African proverb when he said, "If you want to go far, go together. If you want to go quickly, go alone." My dear brothers and sisters, we do not have a choice. We all, whether we're from faith organizations, whether we're from secular civil society, whether we are from progressive business, whether we are from governments, we have to now realize that the choice before us is to be able to move far and quickly at the same time. If we fail to do that, future generations will judge all of us as people who have the voice, the ability, and so on to make a difference, will judge us extremely, extremely harshly. Thank you very, very much for your attention.